Good evening and welcome to Fall Term Commencement, Michigan State University. Tonight, some 698 Michigan State University students will receive degrees. The graduating list includes 148 candidates for the master's degree and 53 doctoral candidates. The commencement speaker tonight is Dr. Arthur Knoblaugh, who is president of Western Illinois University. In just a few moments, we'll be hearing from the Michigan State University Concert Band under the direction of Professor Leonard Falcone. They will play two numbers as the procession arrives here in the main auditorium here on the campus of Michigan State. The first number to be performed by the concert band will be the March Noble by Charles Bach, and the second number, the Fanfare and Processional by Clarence Hurrell, Jr. As this is happening, the graduating students will be filing into the main auditorium, where tonight we have a crowd of some 2,000 or 3,000 in the balcony here of the university auditorium. And as they file in, they are followed in by the processional group, or the platform party. It will be at this time that the first voice then that you will be hearing will be Dr. John A. Hanna, Michigan State University's president, who will introduce a pastor who will present the opening ceremonies for this evening's graduating exercises. This is Fall Term 1960, Michigan State University. Now, the pageantry and color at commencement exercises reveal a record of academic achievement of the various individuals that are taking part in the exercises. We have a brief description that lets you know what is going on. Back in 1894, the Intercollegiate Commission, a group of leading American educators, met at Columbia University to draft a code which would serve to regulate the design of gowns and hoods, indicating the various degrees as well as the colors to indicate the various faculties. This code's been adopted by most of the colleges and universities in America, and its use has made identification of scholastic honors an immediate activity. We'll describe those gowns, but now, the March Noble. Thank you. March Noble, written by Charles Bach, performed by the Michigan State University Concert Band under the direction of Professor Leonard Falcone. The next selection will be the Fanfare and Processional by Clarence Hurrell, Jr. Here is the MSU Concert Band under the direction of Professor Leonard Falcone.
Ladies and gentlemen, we ask our guests to rise and join students and faculty in singing one verse of America, accompanied by the Michigan State University Band under the direction of Professor Leonard Falcone. And then we will remain standing for the invocation, One Verse of America. Invocation will be offered by the Reverend Wallace Robertson, pastor of the People's Church of East Lansing. Mr. Robertson.
Let us unite in prayer. Our Father and our God, we invoke thy blessing upon this commencement service, and upon all the men and women who have completed their course of study leading to a degree. We thank thee for truth and for the community of the mind which earnestly seeks it. Help us to always live in the discipline of mind and freedom of spirit which the quest for truth produces. Guide this great university, its administration, its faculty, and its student body in the constant and creative endeavor to serve thee and the cause of humanity in word and in deed. Motivate us and inspire us, O God, to will to use our privilege of learning and life as a sacred trust dedicated to the enrichment and enhancement of life where'er we touch it. This we pray in the name of the Master of Life, Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
You're listening to Fall Commencement Exercises at Michigan State University, where the main speaker this evening will be Dr. Arthur Nabla, the president of Western Illinois University, an alumnus of Michigan State University, a distinguished educator in many capacities. He'll speak on the topic, Excellence is a Personal Quality. He'll be introduced by MSU University President, Dr. John A. Hanna.
It is a great pleasure to welcome back to this campus and to present as the speaker at this commencement a distinguished graduate of Michigan State University who is widely known as an outstanding educator and educational administrator. He was born in Lenawee County, Michigan. And while his career has taken him to the far corners of the world on occasion, he has always been proud to acknowledge his Michigan heritage. He was graduated from Michigan State in 1929 with highest honors, having majored in science and in political science. He became a teacher in the schools of Buchanan, and there began a career that has placed him in many interesting and responsible positions. He took his Master of Arts degree from the University of Michigan in 1933 and his Doctor of Education degree at Harvard in 1942, again with high honors. At Harvard, he was a McGregor Scholar. Meanwhile, he had become superintendent of schools at Cassopolis and then executive secretary of the Connecticut Education Association. And in 1941, he became a member of the faculty of the University of Connecticut and was advanced to positions of responsibility in the areas of graduate and continuing education. In 1952-53, he was a Fulbright lecturer at the University of Rangoon in Burma and had the opportunity for both extensive travel and intensive investigation of social and educational conditions in Burma, other parts of Asia, and in Europe. In 1955, he accepted the presidency of the Moorhead State College in Minnesota, where he was highly successful, so much so that 3 years later he was summoned to the larger responsibility of the presidency of Western Illinois University at Macomb. He has been a prolific contributor to professional journals and active in church, community, and Boy Scout work wherever he has lived. In 1958, our College of Education designated him as a distinguished graduate, and last June he was honored at our commencement by having a Distinguished Alumni Award conferred upon him. Michigan State University is proud of Dr. Arthur L. Canablo and happy to have a distinguished alumnus address this newest group of alumni to be tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, may I present Arthur Lewis Canablo, president of Western Illinois University, the topic of whose address is Excellence is a Personal Quality. Dr. Canablo.
Thank you, Dr. Hanna, and it's a real privilege for me to be here this evening. President Hanna, graduates, distinguished guests, and colleagues. One cannot return to his alma mater without experiencing the deepest emotional tides of affection and respect. To return as we have this evening is indeed a source of the finest personal satisfaction that can possibly attend a visitor to an institution which has experienced profound developments of the most extraordinary types in all areas of leadership in higher education. These qualities have been extended to all manners of men everywhere. And Western Illinois University is happy to extend its greetings to Michigan State University on this occasion. From a small college of some 2,500 students in the mid-20s, with a distinctly statewide clientele, Michigan State University has developed into an institution of more than 21,000 students with a reputation for excellence that is worldwide. Happily for us tonight, we can ascribe most of the credit for this achievement to President Hanna and his personal qualities of excellence. Here indeed is a man of whom the English philosopher Spencer might well have said, the man preceded the event and thus made even the latter a greater experience in the educational and general history of the peoples of the contemporary world. We have not chosen as our task tonight to deal with the excellence of institutions or even of excellence in the generic sense. Indeed, one who addresses himself to this topic in mid-century America needs only to review the press and the platform of his day to be apprised of the fact that excellence, in all its varied connotations, has been given almost every conceivable type of treatment, save the most pertinent and, may I say, the most critical one. The titles vary from excellence in the 60s through the pursuit of excellence and on to the price of excellence, as discussed in the autumn 1960 issue of Harvard Today. And in this array, one finds almost every conceivable treatment of the topic, and only recently, and I'm sure this will interest you folks, the Chicago Sun-Times carried an editorial entitled Excellence at Notre Dame. And yet something is lacking. This is no particular reference to Notre Dame. To be sure, excellence has become of recent years a promise and a challenge to our national fabric. And today, in all areas of life, it is regarded as vital to our very survival. And yet Mark Twain's observation about the weather, which went something to the effect that everybody talks about it, but nobody does anything about it, seems caustically appropriate at this hour in our history. Our thesis this evening is of a somewhat different nature. Matter of fact, at this point, we're reminded of a pastor friend of ours who assumed a new pastorate and about the fourth Sunday decided that he was going to lecture on the section of the scriptures taken from St. Matthew in which the master fed the multitudes. And in giving the script, he made a mistake and said, I shall now discuss the text of feeding two people with 4,000 loaves and 7,000 fishes. And he didn't discover his mistake. And when he left the church at the end of the service, you know, there's a sort of a systematic way of ushering people out. One grand lady said, well, Reverend, you made a mistake. You got your text all mixed up this morning. You must have had a lot left. And he didn't say anything, and he was polite to her as a new pastor ought to be. The next Sunday he came back because this was a series of sermons dealing with the same thing, and he proposed to give a lecture in the same sermon in the same vein. And this time he got it straight, and the grand lady was not to be outdone. She met him at the door again and said, "Well, you did a little better this time, but you must have run out of food." And he said, "No, madam, I used that we had left over last Sunday." If I were to discuss excellence and all its ramifications, I would have several lectures here, but I'm not going to do that. But if we were to select a text tonight, it would come from the biblical treatment of the development of individual talents as the greatest single lesson ever given to man in any age on the subject of excellence. And in various verses of the 25th chapter of St. Matthew, we read of the man who was going to travel in a far country. And he called his servants together, and he gave them his goods. And you recall this. And unto one he gave 5 talents, to another he gave 2, and to another he gave 1. And every one according to his several abilities. And praise went only to those who used theirs and multiplied them manyfold. In an age that is as specialized and certainly as interdependent as this one seems to be, we are inclined to overlook the fact oft times established that most of man's personal qualities are indivisible and as peculiarly personal as is the self itself. When divisibility occurs through the germplasm and not through the artificial contrivances of men, man is unique, and we must keep him so if civilization as we know it and want it eventually to be is to survive. But survival isn't enough, is to develop. The British scientist and writer Huxley, a few decades ago, wrote of the chills that frequently overtake man. And you recall that most of these chills spring from the fact that man, among all God's creatures, seems slowly but surely to be losing his status as an individual with peculiar qualities in a free society. There are the chills of anxiety. Anxiety, which the physicians, the medical world tells us, kills more people from heart seizures than any other known cause of death. There's the chill of dismay, of fear, of hunger, illiteracy, perplexity, poverty. And in the midst of all of this, there is the chill of plenty. Emerson, a century ago, touched on these chills when he described the uncertainties faced by man in his essay on compensation. And you'll recall that Emerson wrote something like this, and we're deleting some of the lines. "The wings of time are black and white, and now glows the feud of want and have. Man's dual roles as an independent and interdependent being are slowly but surely reducing him in the literal sense to the status of a fear-ridden robot of whom we may soon find it difficult to say with another poet, 'I am the master of my fate, the captain of my soul.'" We shall have more to say about man and the masses and their place in the scheme of things shortly, but here let us emphasize again that they are the solemn responsibility of all of education, including higher education. This is a thing that we've, for almost a century and a half, yes, more than a century and a half, overlooked in these United States, and a thing in which Michigan State has assumed a position of leadership. In some respects, and may I say important ones at that, the advent of Sputnik in October of 1958 reminded us of the fact that we already know, and that is that the able in all of the talents peculiar to man do not replenish their kind. There is an inexorable law that operates in the field of human competencies of whatever character, but we know it only as a statistic and not as a predictable verity of any practical value. All we do know is that no one knows from whence or where or even at what precise moment in history the next Einstein will appear to announce a new formula treating of the still more hidden meanings of a new rule that E equals MC squared, and one that so far this rule has not comprehended. This may create an even newer and more dynamic crisis, if that is possible, in human history. A situation that may remind us, some of the older ones particularly, of the plagues of Europe, of whom the poet wrote in these startling words. And this is much more real than we're inclined to admit. But this poet wrote, in speaking of these plagues, "The sick man started in his bed. The watcher leaped upon the floor. At the cry, 'Bring out your dead,' the cart is at the door. The cart may be at our door sooner than we anticipate." For more than 40 years, we have known Michigan State, and for more than 30 years, we have been closely connected with all types of young and not so young Americans. And all of our experiences have led us to the conclusion that excellence as a human quality is personal and indivisible. If we accept this as our premise tonight, then we are compelled to review once again our thinking on the role of the individual in the general scheme of things. There's really little that is new in this treatment. Almost 25 centuries ago, the Greek philosopher Protagoras authored the famous dictum, "Man is the measure of all things." And slowly but surely, we are beginning to accept the fact that know thyself is really the elementary rule of survival in the world that is ever apace with change, a world about which Heraclitus could proclaim against the doctrines of Parmenides and the other non-changers of his day, Pantareia, or change, change, all is change. Today there are encouraging signs on the receding and confused horizons. In an age of integrated schools and segregated minds, we can at least be hopeful when we see even the faintest flicker of a prospect that slowly but certainly the prestige symbols of our young people are changing. And these changes are in the direction of the recognition of the fact that excellence is a quality that springs ever anew from a characteristic of mankind that is extremely personal and indeed divine. The Problems and Policies Committee of the American Council on Education, writing in October 1960, came close to treating of this topic when it wrote, "In a rapidly changing world, our colleges and universities serve as custodians of the intellectual capital of mankind. They also serve as centers of innovation and change, of investigation of the application of knowledge to current needs, and ever of the re-examination and the criticism of society." The day must end when, as an American politician once remarked, and this was not long ago, quote, "Let me make the deals, and I don't care who makes the ideals," close quote. This marks the tragedy of our times. We need to examine the more personal and vital qualities of man, that when properly appraised and developed, these may become excellent in character. Tonight, we cannot isolate these qualities, or at least we haven't, and give them precise journalistic treatment. But we can discuss them as interrelated and indivisible forces or qualities. We shall depend upon your apperceptive mass and your ability as scholars and your trained minds to give them that nicety of organizational focus, which is so dear to the American heart, but so foreign to American practice. One of the real tragedies of our time. The qualities of excellence that are involved are those that deal with courage, with creativity, with capacity, with compassion, with daring, with independence, with leadership roles, with morality, and a long list of other qualities that will readily occur to a group of this type. Before we continue to consider this side of the coin, permit us, however, to take a briefer look at the opposite side of excellence, which is mediocrity. Indeed, this becomes a second choice of one who prefers to live as a moral man in an immoral society. Bell, in his recent treatment of the general topic, The End of Ideology, points up the conflict that now engulfs responsible men and women everywhere. In speaking of the restless vanity, he quotes from Jacob Burckhardt as follows, and I think this is significant, and this is another real area in which Michigan State has made a tremendous contribution. Quote, "The future belongs to the masses, or to the man who can explain things simply to them." This is fundamental. In a further play on the restless vanity of de Tocqueville's time, he points out that the American in his intercourse with strangers is impatient of the slightest censure and insatiable of praise. And this has been replaced by an anxious inferiority, fearful of censure and desperately eager to please. If you don't believe this, see Americans abroad sometime, and I'm not thinking in terms of the ugly American either. This is indeed an age of changing values, and a time in which even the able seem only too willing to surrender whatever unusual qualities they may have in an effort to gain either status or security. These are extremely diametric qualities, and at least a part of our thesis this evening is that we find it difficult to have one with the other. Thus, our society in our times must recognize once again that genuine security rests upon the thesis that a creative person should be secure at whatever he or she undertakes in a truly democratic situation. To attempt to function under any other principle of conduct would almost certainly ensure to all degrees of capacities, including mediocrity, that nothing, no one shall be disturbed. This, we submit, is the invariable tendency of mass action when it operates in technical situations and in a scientific age such as that the world is experiencing today. Mediocrity tends to ensure its own security And whatever else may be said of our generation and of our times, it ought to be noted that misinformation is far more abundant than is accurate information, and this in an age of specialists when reliable information on almost any topic is certainly available. Emotional thinking has become the order of our day, and may I submit that emotional thinking won't save any form of government, including a democracy. This is a dangerous way to be living. As educated men and women, we have responsibilities in many areas that may at times seem remote to even the expert observer of the rapidly changing human scene. In every area of human existence today, the cry is for more able leaders, and it doesn't speak well for our society when it contrives devices and arrangements whereby leadership is thwarted and frustrated and finally penalized in whatever manner that a society which regards the person with ideas as being somewhat old-fashioned, or at least to admit of having ideas, is old-fashioned. For when men do this, they are guilty of seceding from the seceders, as Emerson once described the conservatives and the liberals of another abused age. A friend of mine was campaigning for office in Tennessee in the last general election. I saw him just the other day. He was back up in the hills of Tennessee, and this is the kind of situation we're in. And he had discovered during the process of his campaign, Dr. Hanna, that he ought not to mention too strongly that he is either a member of one party or the other, and finally someone caught up with him, and the man stood up in the audience and said, "Sir, you haven't told us whether you're a Republican or Democrat. What are you?" And he said, "Well, I'll tell you, young man, I have friends who are Republicans, and I have friends who are Democrats, and I'm a friend of my friends." And this is the course some of us take, isn't it? The very real challenge to our day and our generation springs quietly from the chills that the scientist Huxley noted some 20 years ago, and which we have already cited and enumerated earlier in these passages. These chills endanger our personal and collective status, as Bell has so aptly written. Quote, "In a world of lonely crowds, seeking individual distinction, where values are constantly translated into economic calculabilities, where in extreme situations shame and conscience can no longer restrain the most dreadful excesses of terror." And look at the Congo tonight. And this man was writing this before the Congo, the African situation developed. "The theory of the mass society seems a forceful, realistic description of contemporary society as an accurate reflection of the quality and feeling of modern life. But when one seeks to apply the theory of mass society analytically, it becomes very slippery. Ideal types like the shadows in Plato's cave generally never give us more than a silhouette. So too with the theory of mass society. In this age of the mass society, we need to analyze this society or this concept, this usage of this concept, shall I say, in order to chart a plan for whatever society exists, and we need to know what this mass is that we hear so much about in contemporary times." Bell emphasizes that the mass concept could represent five different notions or concepts, very briefly. One, the undifferentiated mass. This is a mass with which we are, most of us, familiar. Two, mass is a judgment of the incompetent, and this in the sense that Ortega was referring to it in his Revolt of the Masses in 1931. And three, mass as a mechanized society, and this is a German notion that man is a cog in a technological press or machine. And four, mass as a bureaucratized society, the organization man, and the man Emerson spoke of, as we shall see shortly. This isn't anything new, because Emerson wrote more than a century ago. The mass, five, the mass is a mob. And here we eliminate all differences, as Hannah Arendt has observed in her memorable treatment of this topic. The masses become obsessed by a desire to escape from reality because in their essential homelessness, they can no longer bear its accidental, incomprehensible aspects. In the role of the devil's advocate tonight, may we say that during our lifetime, literally volumes have been written on the general topic of the challenges facing leadership in their leadership role today, and why apparently many people fail in this respect. Why do we fail to maximize our usage of our human resources? Most of the writings in this area have been produced by clever merchants of words who have searched too hard to find Hegel's black cow in an even darker forest later at night. And as a simple matter of fact, the reason for withdrawal from the role has been obvious for decades. I'm reminded of an experience I had some 2 years ago while attending a board meeting in the city of Chicago. Some window washer apparently leaned a little bit too far out of the fourth story and fell out of the window. Very fortunately for him, he landed on an awning and he bounced off, and he was just dazed when he got on the street, when he fell on the street. But he didn't get up right away, and in the meantime, crowds are curious, and we're talking about masses, and this is rather appropriate. And so he sat up first, and along came a policeman after some 50 people had gathered and pounded him on the sole of his shoe and said, "What's going on here, bub?" And he said, "Well, sir, I don't know, officer. I just got here myself." And this is about the way many of us react. This reason is closely akin to that of most of our classroom failures, and indeed the more general failures in all areas of our everyday life. Give a man an unimaginative and an uncreative job to do, and we don't care how much procedural advice you give him, he'll still fail. Leadership calls for more than normographic means of expression, for more than just time-consuming tasks on the job. This is largely what we have been busy doing since the stage setting, human dynamics, role-playing, participation advocates got into full swing. Now, Dr. Hanna, that sentence can get me into a lot of trouble, but let me bail myself out. Indeed, all of what has been written and done has not been bad. It just hasn't been good enough. In other words, it's still a challenge for us to continue our work in these fields. If we're going to get ourselves out of the conforming class, intelligent or useless or otherwise. May I be more personal? Every autumn we watch with interest as a new freshman class enrolls at the university. As we observe, we note that slowly but surely the new student loses his identity and his individuality tends to disappear, and equally as fast or equally as slow, the upper class pattern emerges. Gone for as long as we can observe are those vital personal qualities that the parents from literally hundreds of rich homes gave these young people. If one pursues this line of thought far enough and long enough, he could observe the emergence of the graduate school pattern, or shall we say the graduate school complex. Here one knows what clubs to join, what books and periodicals to read, and even on occasion how to vote. The skill at repetition and conformity is absolute. What a gross tragedy. And what a vast wastage of our vital human resources is here evident on every hand. And this has led some wag to say that our universities are marvelous storehouses of knowledge because the freshmen bring in so much and the seniors take out so little. This may not apply in this part of the country, but it applies with us. This trend leaves this abused age with the feeling that once again, things are in the saddle and they ride mankind. We aren't failing because our tasks are creative, daring, and filled with human compassion. No, we're failing to meet these personal national standards because the challenges of conformity have left us with nothing original to do. I hesitate to say this because once the Commissioner of Finance in Minnesota came up and gave a lecture like this on our campus, and the next day we had a strike. I don't want to induce anything like that. There are enough problems in ordinary university life without some professional medicine man coming in and telling you that this is the thing to do. But I do think there's a tremendous challenge in this area. If our generation fails to achieve its goals, it will fail because the procedural techniques by which we accomplish mankind's goals are so numerous and so varied, and they are pitched at such an elementary and frustrating level that at best they serve to give a false interpretation of what is good practice, democratic or otherwise. And need I remind this audience that democracy is not a form of government. It is rather a principle of government, a theory about man rather than a theory of the state. Ours is the product of an age of conformity at its best, an age in which to be different is to be ostracized by those who really know better, but who climb to their goals over minds that are long since dead. We have seen the effects of this scourge on all elements of our society and at all stages of our personal and national existence. Don't be an egghead. Don't be a brain. Don't be different in any way. How else can we account for the docile conduct on the part of countless millions of our fellow men? Yet listen to Bell once more as he describes this situation in contemporary society. The curious fact, perhaps, is that no one in the United States defends conformity. Everyone is against it, and probably everyone always was. 35 years ago, you could easily rattle any middle-class American by charging him with being a Babbitt. Today, you can do so by accusing him of conformity. The problem is to know who is accusing whom. In December 1958, the Reader's Digest, with a circulation, I think, of about 12 million, reprinted an article from Woman's Day, another publication with a circulation of about 5 million, with the title of The Danger of Being Too Well Adjusted. The point of the article is that great men were not adjusted. And the article quotes a psychiatrist who says that we've made conformity into a religion. We ought to remember, however, that each child is different and ought to be different. The psychiatrist, you know, that's a situation in which the id is studied by the odd, isn't it? Men or women who were employed because they seemed to possess both talent and time, slowly but surely found that it was easier to give only of their time. We haven't as yet learned to tend our soul as Plato advised. Our concern has been almost entirely with the ego and with status. We must sit, and not only sit on the 50-yard line, but we must be seen sitting on the 50-yard line. And if, as Socrates observed, no one does wrong willingly, then virtue is knowledge and vice is sheer ignorance. Then the challenge to leadership is obvious, and most of us would not become managers of men just to escape the chores of creative leadership if the latter were our only other alternative. Indeed, we submit that the greatest weakness in all of American culture today is the insecurity that surrounds creativity on every hand, in the classroom, in the shop, on the farm, in the principal's office, at home, or in the superintendent's or president's chair, and even, may I say, the laboratory today has its intruders. In this respect, the rest of the educated world has surpassed us everywhere, save possibly in Russia, and our visit to Russia in 1959 convinced us that their system will eventually fail because of its own oppressive weight. Creativity in Russia is stifled for yet other reasons, and this must not concern us in a brief paper of this kind. May we now suggest that Mannheim's comment on the nature of thought in the 1930s, particularly as it is applied to group thinking, was perhaps the best work in the field during this century or any other century. And I never could understand why our more progressive schools of education didn't tackle on this, because this was a tremendous approach. It's one of those new ideas that we had every 5 years since that Moravian monk in the 16th century, but we missed it. The recent writings and the rise of organizational top-heavy industrial groups in the past 4 decades supply food for additional thought and are very appropriate at this point, but we're not going to discuss them either. We just want to call them to your attention. We want only to point out that we passed over these researches and writings in the nature of thought and organizational structures rather lightly and perhaps for a horse of another color. This in the presence of the fact that our society is going to become increasingly more of the nature that Mannheim discussed as early as the early 1930s. We thought, or did we think, that Kant was right when he spoke of the wonders of the universe. And you remember that memorable phrase of his, "Two things," said Kant, "fill me with breathless awe, the starry heavens and the moral law." And thank goodness for a man like Markham, because he came right back, our own Markham, and said, "But I know a thing more awful and obscure, the long, long patience of the plundered poor." These masses of which we speak tonight, these are the masses that need to experience the best of our personal leadership qualities if our way of life is to survive. It is to be regretted that our generation has sought to aid the plundered poor without ever stopping to define its task or outline its objectives. We have erroneously assumed, as others have observed, that to be different is to be bad. Remember this. We have erroneously observed, and we've acted on this principle, that to be different is to be bad. While living with the lovely people of Burma a few years ago, we learned that other customs and other cultures have much to offer the nation, as well as the individual, who earnestly undertakes to understand other people. There are some in the present social milieu who assume and contend that the leader's job is to keep a safe distance behind the social frontier in order to avoid self-destruction. Apparently, it has never occurred to them that man needs to be ever at the task of remaking his society, as Kant said, or his society will fail him. Indeed, with all of our learned qualities, we have only imperfectly discovered that Emerson may have been right when he wrote, "Man is a farmer, or a professor, or an engineer, or all. Man is priest and scholar and statesman and producer and soldier." In a divided or social sense, these functions are parceled out to individuals, each of whom aims to do his stint of the joint work, whilst each other performs his. The fable implies that the individual, to possess himself, must sometimes return from his own labor to embrace all the other laborers. But unfortunately, this original unit, this fountain of power, has been so distributed to multitudes, has been so minutely subdivided and peddled out, and we're talking about the same thing we mentioned a little while ago, that it is spilled into drops and it cannot be gathered. The state of society is one in which the members have suffered amputation from the trunk and strut about so many walking monsters. the good finger, a neck. I hesitate to mention the other one because it's caused lots of trouble in America. A stomach, an elbow, but never a man. Man is thus metamorphosed into a thing, into many things. The planter who is man sent out into the field to gather the food. And he's seldom cheered by any idea of the true dignity of his ministry. The tradesman scarcely ever gives an ideal worth to his work, but is ridden by the routine of his craft, and the soul is subject to dollars. The priest becomes a form, the attorney a statute book, the mechanic a machine, the sailor a rope in the ship. In this distribution of functions, the scholar is the delegated intellect. In the right state, he is man thinking. In the degenerate state, when the victim of society, he tends to become a mere thinker, or still worse, the parrot of other man's thinking. In this scheme of things, the individual becomes a reader of the guidebook, and leadership proceeds on the normothetic basis. He follows the procedural analysis of his job and finds the keys where the guide indicates they are to be found, or he spells out his responsibility in a handbook that simplifies life to all manners of men under all circumstances and everywhere, and we've had altogether too much of this. Finally, we submit that the world is fully real, that man is the measure of all things, that we haven't learned very much if we contend by word or practice that creativity, that courage, that capacity, that compassion, that daring, that independence, that morality, and all of the other fine personal qualities that are divisible forces and that procedural nicety can serve as a substitute for these qualities. Above all, daring is essential in the age in which we find ourselves. And this must be combined with the assurance that in a democratic society, all may fail and all may rise again. Have we forgotten the parallels in history, in science, in music, in art, in literature, in medicine? Yes, and in downright human kindness that exemplified by the Good Samaritan. Listen to Emerson just once more. The great man makes the great thing. Wherever MacDonald sits, there is the head of the table. Linnaeus makes botany the most alluring of studies and wins it from the farmer and the herb woman. Davy makes chemistry. Cuvier, fossils. The day is always his who works in it with serenity and with great aims. The unstable estimates of men crowd to him whose mind is filled with the truth as the heaped waves of the Atlantic follow the moon. Yes, we've forgotten that man is one. I believe that man has been wronged. What's more, he has wronged himself. He has almost lost the light that can lead him back to his prerogatives. Remember, this is Emerson speaking a century ago. Men are become of no account. Men in history, men in the world of today are bugs, are spawns, and are called the mass and the herd. Almost of this century, isn't it? The task we face calls for the creation of an atmosphere that will release these creative forces in our contemporary society, that will recognize that excellence is a personal quality, or we shall fail in the very midst of an age that knows better but seems to be unable to practice what he knows. This could be the worst of the great historical tragedies. This is also the challenge that arises from the recognition that excellence is, in reality, a personal quality. Our task is to develop a climate of excellence that is less concerned with where its ideas come from and more ready to make constructive human use of them, whatever their source. An age in which to have ideas is to be called blessed by all who count in times when courage and vision should combine to give wisdom its push. An age in which, as Bell says, the social tensions that are an expression of unfulfilled expectations close can and must be whipped. The worldwide emphasis by all nations upon the value of an educated populace should shake us loose from any notion that only democracy as a form of government or governing our interpersonal affairs needs an educated citizenry. How long we've been lulled to sleep by that song. Education for what ends? Listen to John Stuart Mill when writing on liberty and referring to Comte's essay on a system of positive politics, in which Comte, you remember, aims at the establishment of a despotism of society over the individual. Mill observes as follows. Apart from the peculiar tenets of individual thinkers, there is also in the world at large an increasing inclination to stretch unduly the powers of society over the individual, both by the force of opinion and even by that of legislation. And as a tendency of all changes taking place in the world is to strengthen society and diminish the power of the individual, this encroachment is not one of the evils which tend spontaneously to disappear, but on the contrary, to grow ever and ever more formidable. Need we say more? Excellence in these vital areas is indeed a personal quality, and is only as man emerges from the hordes of men in these instances that he ensures more than mere racial survival. To survive is not enough, for survival could be in chains, but to survive in God's image is sufficient, and this must be our goal as we strive for excellence in our personal qualities. And yes, may I add, I trust that in the bivouac of life, we will not be like dumb-driven cattle, but we will all be a hero in the strife. May I congratulate you upon this congratulation. Thank you. This graduation. Thank you.
You've been listening to the commencement address by Dr. Arthur Nablaugh, the president of Western Illinois University.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
This will conclude our broadcast from the main auditorium in the Michigan State University Auditorium here on the campus. This concludes our broadcast portion of the 1960 Fall Commencement Exercises. Jack Hogan speaking, our engineer Clint Eaton. We now switch you back to our main studios.